Oh, it offends me to the soul to hear a robustious, periwig-painted fellow tear a passion to tatters, to very rags, to split the ears of the groundlings, who for the most part are capable of nothing but inexplicable dumb shows and noise.
Well, Henny, you better hang on to your bear bodkin, because you're going to hate this. It's John Malden, your host of the Inexplicable Dumb Show, starting now.
Hi, and welcome to episode 276 of the Inexplicable Dumb Show. I'm John Malden. That's right, more Humana this week. More coverage of the 36th annual Humana Festival of New American Plays, hosted by Actors Theatre of Louisville. And this week, I'm going to talk with Lucas Neff, the playwright of Death Tax, and Courtney Barron, the playwright of Eat Your Heart Out. And we'll get into that right after these brief messages. If you love the Inexplicable Dumb Show as much as I do, don't be shy about it. Go ahead and wear your feelings on your sleeve, or at least your chest. Head on over to our Cafe Press store and wear your support for the IDS proudly. www.cafepress.com/dumbshow.
Hi, I am someone you will probably never meet. Yet I ask you to take time
to think about people you don't know but need your help. Children, some of them. And they don't all play in the gutter, of course.
Well, maybe if it's called for.
These men, women, and yes, even the children are professional actors. They want and need your time, money, and support.
For just pennies a second, you can enjoy the fruits of their labor. Make sure they know you heard about them on the Inexplicable Dumb Show. They may look at you funny, but that doesn't matter. It's for the children.
It's for the children.
It's time once again for some deep fried theater!
We're at Humana Festival, and I'm joined by Lucas Neff, playwright extraordinaire, who has just been drenched in his walk over here. So, playwright of Death Tax. So, thanks for, as you dry out and kind of regroup early on a Sunday morning after the weekend of Humana, welcome.
Thank you.
So, you've been to Humana before, right? In the 10-minute play, kind of?
I had a play in a January festival of 10-minute plays that the apprentices do that happens before Humana. It was about 2 years ago, I think. Mm-hmm. I had written a play called The Courtship of Anna Nicole Smith, mm-hmm. and that was performed in the January 10s. But that's how I got to know the theater.
Okay. And where you were based in New York and teaching at NYU?
Yeah, I teach at NYU. Mm-hmm. Live in New York.
Are you a native New Yorker or transplant?
I'm a transplant. I've been in New York for about somewhere between 13 and 14 years now. I'm originally from Orlando, Florida.
Oh, you're a native Floridian. That's even more rare.
I grew up about 7 minutes from the Magic Kingdom.
Oh, wow. Most magic place on earth.
In a Buckminster Fuller geodesic dome house.
Nice. There you go. The reason I say that is I went to grad school down in Florida at Florida Atlantic in Boca Raton, Florida.
Oh, okay.
And, so I, especially down there, everybody is from somewhere else. So it's a very, it's a very transient sort of thing. So getting on to your play, what kind of was your impetus?
Well, my mother's a hospital chaplain. And so one day she called me, it was probably back in 2005 or something like that. She told me that there were some nurses that she had heard were taking payments from the children of patients in decline in order to have those patients die a little faster because they were just kind of lingering and eating into the family savings. Mm-hmm. And I thought that sounded like kind of an interesting scam. So I started playing around with it in some scenes. And then subsequently, when I mentioned to her that I was writing a play about it, she said, "No, I never said that to you. I don't know where you got that from."
Denial of plausibility.
So that too also actually in a weird way influenced the play. The slippery nature of what's true and what's not.
Well, I find it fascinating from multiple avenues, but the fact that it's kind of in this nursing home, hospital, doctor, nurse relationship. Because, personally, my dad, for years used to run hospitals.
Oh, okay.
He was a hospital administrator and had to deal with
sometimes some of the issues that are brought up in your play. And I was fascinated by Maxine's, that's Maxine, right?
The older woman, yes. Yeah.
Okay. I was fascinated by her will to live and how that sustained her almost to the point, really, of, you know, the medicine and the technology at the end there. Mm-hmm. And that kind of drive, because again, from my personal experience, I had a great aunt who, broke her hip, right? And she absolutely abhorred nursing homes. And, the nurse made a mistake of saying, other than the hip, she was perfectly healthy.
Yeah.
So, the nurse made the mistake of telling my mom that she might have to stay in a nursing home for a while. Well, next day she was dead.
Oh my goodness.
Because she, I guess, just decided, the converse of Maxine was,
yeah,
I'm done, you know?
Yeah.
I'm over. And it was just fascinating. And I liked how the relationship between, in your play, about how the doctor and the nurse and everything kind of developed and reached its point. And then I thought it was fascinating that you flipped the actors to play the future variations that you have in the, was that intentional, or did they go,
it was definitely intentional. There was a, I remember actually working on the play when I was writing the play originally, I kept on writing different versions of scene five, the final scene in the play. And, many of them were, you know, kind of the obvious version of scene five, which is whatever you would expect would happen immediately after scene four. And I found that, almost always disappointing, or at worst, it turned into a kind of, episode of Law and Order. Nothing wrong with Law and Order, but it just felt a little too, flimsy almost for the stage. And, that's what's wonderful about Law and Order is all those, there's something kind of, it's like newspaper. It's sort of like,
right,
you get one, you throw it out, you get another, you throw it out. So, and that's what it is. Whereas theater, you kind of want it to be something that smashes the time space continuum in some way. So, I remember just talking to a friend and saying, you know what I wish I could do for the final scene? I wish I could just, you know, jump ahead 20 years. And, but I'm not going to do that. And then by the time I got home, I thought, okay, what the hell?
Yeah.
Let me just give it a try and see what happens. And that seemed to be the version that worked. But, part of one of the ingredients of it working is that it needed to, in some way, we needed to have, kind of a ghost of characters that, we knew from the first four scenes. Mm-hmm. Like, they, in some way, they had to be present in that last scene. So that's why I decided to double cast the last scene using the same actors who played Tina and Todd playing other characters, because there's a sense, I think, in which you're still seeing Tina and Todd,
right,
just reincarnated.
Right, right. Yeah, I don't want to give you the impression that it threw me off or anything, but I would, what I felt was, for the actors, you know, that you've spent the hour and, you know, 15 minutes or whatever it was, in this really intense, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, here's a new person that you have to suddenly become. It would be a great actor challenge.
Yeah.
And they handled it really, really, really well. And you kind of had to have, it's probably too flippant to say that, but you kind of had to have a comeuppance for sort of Maxine. I felt like there had to be some sort of, I don't know if you want to call it a universal kick in the pants or whatever, but it seemed like that was also a key thing, that even though she's still fighting to live and live and live and live, eventually, you know, death comes to us all, basically, right? She kind of has burned through her bridges.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we do need that.
And I, you know, because she's, in one instance, she's almost a completely unlikable character, but you sort of do, because there's, I think you rally to the thought of wanting to be alive. It's kind of this sort of, I'm not going to say redeeming quality, because it's not, but it's a universal quality that we strive for, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of times people will talk about stories in terms of having likable and unlikable characters, and I always found that a bit confusing. I don't know what that means. Everybody likes different things, so I don't know how there can be a universally likable character. And so when I think people say that there's an unlikable character in a play, they're actually responding to something different. They're just responding to an inability to understand why that character wants what they want.
Right.
Richard III goes around killing children, and yet we feel weirdly compelled to even root for him at times. And it's just because we understand what he wants and what's at stake for him. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of empathy that happens that is beyond approval or disapproval of the character's actions. So that's what I'm hoping to get at with Maxine, that even though she does some horrible things, hopefully we get a sense of why she wants what she wants, why that's so important. I think we can all understand the desire to keep on living.
Right. And what is next for this play?
I don't know. There's a good bit of talk right now about future productions of the play, but I think it's a conversation that's going to begin on Monday. I have a lot of emails I need to return and phone calls I need to return.
Well, that's so great. That's
yeah,
great.
It is. It's. I'm overwhelmed by the response to it. People have been coming out of the woodwork to ask for the play and to look at it and talk to me about it that I would have never thought.
And you know, I think where it hits too with the audience, because I noticed it in the woman that was sitting next to me, that, you know, we chatted, but I don't know her life history, right? But it seemed like the daughter-mother relationship, what are we going to do with, you know, mom as she's passing on, or hopefully passing on or whatever. Yeah. I could see that resonate in her somehow, you know, and I think that is the strength of your writing and the strength of the actors that, but it again hits kind of this unit. We're all going to have to face this. Some have already, some are in the process of, and some have yet to bear that, you know, cross or whatever. But I could just, there were moments that she gasped when it was especially about, you know, the daughter-mother relationships and that sort of thing. So I think that was a kudos to a strong story and again, a well-done production. Before I let you go, any major changes to the play that came that you had here and then in the rehearsal process?
Yeah, really. Well, no, what's funny about it is actually when I found out the play was going to be done here back in October, I had actually never heard the play read.
Wow.
It never been workshopped at all. So in November, I put together a reading at New Dramatis, which is a playwriting residency that I'm part of. I put together a reading over there, and I thought, oh gosh, there's a lot of work to do. I sent the theater a 5-page single-spaced letter explaining to them everything about the play that worked and why, and everything about the play that didn't work and why, and what I was going to do to fix it. Not that they didn't ask for any changes. I was all self-motivated. And then from there, I made really, really drastic changes to the play. Scene 3 was completely rewritten from ground up. The fourth scene of the play, while I was up here in rehearsal, I wrote somewhere between 10 and 15 versions of that scene. The actors didn't get the scene until... They weren't allowed to start memorizing lines until, gosh, 2 days before tech.
Wow.
And they were troopers. They were really patient with me, but we kept on saying, nope, it's not there yet. Don't start memorizing.
Well, that's good, because it's hard to unlearn something once you learn it.
Yeah, this is true. And very drastic changes made, I think between October and now, I've probably written play. I don't know if I can even count. I mean,
right.
Definitely somewhere between 20 and 30 drafts.
Wow,
of play.
Wow.
I do a lot of drafts.
Well, are you at a point where Or do you ever get to that point where you're like, okay, I'm going on. I've gotta go. This is it. I'm walking away.
I'm gonna do one more. I'm gonna make. I know what they are too. I have them marked in my script. And it's just some more tweaks, just to tighten it up even more.
Well, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
All right, so I'm joined by Courtney Barron, playwright of Eat Your Heart Out. Welcome. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hey, no problem. I have to say, I really, really enjoyed your play, in so much of actually relating to a lot of the issues that were raised up in the play. Thanks for that.
I already like this conversation.
I'm good. Yes, you like me. But no, I thought, I think it addresses a lot of issues, and especially the body image stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't know. I know, because one of the things that I also am, besides a podcaster, is an actor.
All right.
And so that kind of body image thing works for the men as well.
Of course.
For the women. So, I thought it was a very brave piece, and I thought the acting was very strong. And
yes, me too.
And I thought just the moment when she's in the dressing room was an incredibly, just a brave thing for an actor to stand there and do, or any human being to say, this is what I am.
Right, exactly.
literally stripped bare almost. So, is this your first trip?
At Humana in 99 and 2000.
So for a while then, right?
Yeah, it's been a long time.
So were the previous things full lengths? Or?
No, the first year that I came, they were doing the 10-minute plays with an umbrella of a theme, which was life under 30. Mm. And now I'm back, and I'll be 40 this year. So there it is. Welcome to life in the theater, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the second year, I did one of the anthologies for The Apprentice Company.
Okay, cool. So how has it been working on this particular piece with this particular group of actors this particular time?
I can say without hesitation that this has truly been one of the most amazing working experiences I've had. And it's been for a lot of reasons. One, I've been aching to come back to Humana for a long time because when I came before for the 10-minute plays, I had just finished grad school. Mm. I mean, really, truly just finished. And so it was such a gift to have affirmation, even of a 10-minute play that soon after graduating. And when I came, because it's such a playwright-centric theater, you're sort of treated like, the emperors of the theater. And that's such an amazing thing. And then, I've spent now the last years in my career hoping to get back to a place where I felt a little bit like that. And that because Actors Theater takes such good care of the playwrights and really, when you come, the first feeling you have is that everybody is here to service your play mm-hmm. and not their own careers. And that...
Right.
That's sort of mind-blowing. And I did get this tremendous cast who were so game from the get-go. And I was able to, because they were so game and so talented, to do a tremendous amount of rewrites in the room all the way up through the opening.
Wow.
And for me, that's the part of playwriting that I like the best is in the room writing with the actors. So to get to do it in such a significant way here, make such big changes, that it was so great.
What was probably the biggest change in the script for you?
Oh, goodness.
Or the one that caught you most by surprise?
I think the biggest changes came towards the end of the play. I'm sometimes, my Achilles heel is to sort of get caught up in the placement of words and how that's working as a more intellectual pursuit. And this play really needed its emotional weight. Mm-hmm. And so, what would happen in the rehearsal room is that the scenes would come to their end and all of the information of what was going to happen emotionally was there in the text, but the actual, expression of the emotion wasn't there. So that what happened was, it's I got to write past the point of my comfort level, and that was the biggest change. So that what happens is that the accumulation at the end was much greater than it was in the original script in terms of what happens for each character and their emotional and a little bit their plot journeys.
Right. I do kind of like the that it wasn't necessarily, the ending wasn't as
locked down tight, you know, in a nice bow of an ending. You know, I like that because it allowed me as the audience to enjoy each character and then hope for them.
Right.
You know, that who knows, maybe the it may never work out and they may never solve their issues, but they may.
Right. That I'm glad to hear that, because my hope and how the play resolved, which was the first thing I knew about this play, was how it's going to end. And I wanted to make sure that what was layered into the ending was a tremendous amount of potential, which is exactly what I think you just expressed. So I'm so glad to hear that. I mean, and I think the other thing that was so great about this production is I think the danger of this play is that it does begin and you feel like it's a comedy, a sort of standard comedy in some ways, and that at some point it has to start making its shift into something a little bit, deeper is not the right word, but it's the one I'm going to use now. And without a really strong cast and director, that turn can be it can be not just uncomfortable for the audience, but so out of the blue that you can't go with it.
Right.
And here in this production, I feel like they found that tone so that when you make that, so you're sort of coming around the curve and you're like, oh, wait a minute, I'm heading someplace a little darker than I thought I was going to, that they do it with such finesse that you don't feel blindsided, you feel like it's inevitable.
Right. And some of the staging and being in the round and everything, just to borrow kind of a photographic term, it seemed to me that, especially in some of the scene changes as the play towards the end, where the worlds sort of collide spatially, very interesting sort of superimposed images, if you will, were very striking, because it was at one point Evie is in the adoptive parents sort of from where I was sitting. She was, when it went froze, they were in the, and it was, she's right there in their house, and it popped in, you know, wow, what interesting possibilities of that relationship could be, you know.
Right.
And so I'm glad to see that that you again sort of hinted at what that might be. It might just be at the end, she's in the hospital and the mom shows up, everybody goes away, or, you know, maybe there's a bond between the adoptive mother and this girl and that sort of thing. So I found it was very touching.
Thank you.
And I enjoyed it a lot. So what is next for this?
For this,
I wish I knew. The dreaded question, right?
No, I wish I knew. You know, I mean, I hope I'll find out something after the festival. There isn't anything that is already in the works. So, but you know, one of the great things about this festival is that a lot of people from the industry do come to see it, and you know, I sort of hope that will help give it its second life. So that's...
Well, I think it. You know, I'm not a producer, but I think you. I'm hoping.
Me too.
I mean, beyond your personal success, I hope this, you know.
Well, I mean, I think for me, writing the character of Evie, who has such a huge body image issue and who is heavy and all of that, that it's, you know, it's clearly one of my own issues, and I am always struck by how it's not dealt with on the stage, and how even when we were casting this, that the conversation had to come up of, like, how overweight does she need to be, and what does that mean, and can we find an actor that's actually that overweight? And it's such a bizarre sort of back and forth.
Over that that much overweight and a good actor.
It's that's like, right.
Those aren't mutually, you know, exclusive.
No, and it's true that, you know, I mean, in speaking to some, you know, some actresses didn't want to touch it for that reason, like, to be sort of cast in that light. And so I'm so grateful to Sarah Grodzki for doing it, but all of the issues in the play are important to me, but I think in terms of what I hope this play can do sort of beyond me is create a role for that woman that I know is out there and really good and really deserves to have a moment to say, you know, like, we're all sort of not talking about this thing that is painful and hard and also okay.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right. Well, all right. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Would you like to be a pal of the Inexplicable Dumb Show? Why don't you head on over to www.inexplicabledumbshow.com and look for the Hosting Donations Accepted button. Press that and make a donation and help the Dumb Show cover its web hosting fees. Your donation is greatly appreciated. Thank you for your support. So I'd like to thank Lucas Nath and Courtney Barron for stopping by and chatting with me about their plays. Respectively, Lucas Nath is Death, Tax, and Courtney Barron's Eat Your Heart Out. More Humana, Last Humana coverage is next week. In the meantime, if you are interested in seeing Of Mice and Men at the Boiler Room Theater, I'll be playing Lenny. So go on and get your tickets at BoilerRoomTheater.com. So More Humana next week. Thank you so much. Hey, we'll see you. Bye.
Are you a music lover? Then let Magnatune dazzle you with how different we are from the rest of the music industry. Interesting independent artists in diverse genres. Perfect quality wave files in addition to MP3s and many other formats. Instant album downloads or traditional CDs by mail with free shipping. All this and half of every sale goes directly to the artist. So visit us now at magnatune.com. That's M-A-G-N-A-T-U-N-E. Magnatune. We are not evil.
This podcast is a member of the Blueberry Network. Blueberry. No East. That's Blueberry, BLUBRRY .com. Blueberry.com.
Pop Alternative Media.